Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. It's my honor today to welcome to the program for our second monthly update on land warfare trends, Gabe Camarillo, the Undersecretary of the United States Army. Sir, thanks very much for joining us today. It's an honor and pleasure having you back on the program.
Fantastic to be here with you, Vago.
And before we get started, a word from the sponsor of our monthly updates on land warfare. American Rheinmetall is supporting the U.S. Armed Forces on critical programs that enhance lethality, mobility, and situational awareness, including innovative precision fires, smart mission systems, and tracked and wheeled combat vehicles. Sir, congratulations on averting a government shutdown, which is kind of the good news. But unfortunately, it's another continuing resolution, and we're not going to see budgetary certainly until after the State of the Union address next week, and indeed not probably until late March when you approach the end of government funding one more time. But the challenge here is that you're still not operating under a real budget. You were joined last week by your fellow unders, Eric Raven of the Navy, as well as Christian Jones of the Air Force, to make the case and use some specifics on how continuing resolutions are not just impeding the force, but actually impeding us in one of our premier tasks, which is rearming the force, given the unprecedented support and really the incredible support the United States Army has been providing from its stocks under presidential drawdown and congressional authority. Can you get a little bit more specific on the CR impact on that rearmament, both in the near term as well as on the long term? You mentioned Patriot, but I know the damage goes farther than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Vago, I would just start by saying that, you know, we're looking at the fact that, you know, we're basically operating under half of the fiscal year without an FY24 appropriation. And as I said earlier in the week, I think there's a misperception out there that given the size of the Army or the DoD's budget, that we can weather those storms without too many impacts. And the reality is that there are some pretty significant challenges because the funding is not in the right places or in the right accounts. Increases that restrict, that are planned for in 24 that we just don't have the appropriation or the authorization for really limit what we can do in some of our modernization programs or our military construction projects. And it all compounds a lot of the challenges that we have as we're trying to do everything we can to take care of our soldiers, modernize the Army, and provide, kind of a strong demand signal to the industrial base as we're trying to replenish our stocks in things like critical munitions. So as we look at the lack of a 24 appropriation, as you can imagine, you know, back when the budget was developed for the FY24 submission, we intended to be able to marry a lot of the investments that were being done in supplementals in FY23 with production quantities that were planned for in the 24 budget we submitted to Congress. So one example is we were going to move towards a multi-year production contract for things like GMLRS and PAC-3, the missile segment enhancement, which is the new interceptor. We wanted to buy significant numbers of new quantities of those two programs to be able to match the increase in production quantities that were made possible through supplemental funding. And also, we wanted to send the signal to industry that we were committed to a long-term production signal or demand level to help kind of encourage further investments, whether it's, as you know, additional shifts for production or new facilities or, unique tooling that's required. And, you know, frankly, without the appropriation, we cannot get those added quantities on contract. So we're about $1 billion short, a little over $1 billion on PAC-3 MSC. And then, of course, the ramp ups on all of our critical munitions, quantities on GMLRS, on Javelin, the ability to spend some RDT on RDT&E on Stinger. And then, of course, what we're doing on 155 artillery and to be able to buy the quantities that we need in order to replenish our stocks. We can't get where we want to go without the 24 appropriation. So those are some very vivid examples. And I would just offer one more. You know, we saw the very tragic loss earlier this year of three of our soldiers in the Middle East due to an enemy attack from a UAV. Our ability to field counter UAS defensive systems is also being impacted by the current FY24 stalemate. And so I pointed out earlier this week that, for example, the 24 budget submission had funding for 225 Coyote interceptors, which are capable of defeating, you know, the most lethal versions of these UAV threats that we face around the world, particularly in the CENTCOM area of responsibility. And we can't buy those without the 24 appropriation. So it's really starting to cause some areas of significant concern for us.
We've already spent 15 years talking and complaining about having to live like this. And unfortunately, we continue to live like this almost 15 years. From your perspective, right, you've been on the Hill. You started your career on the Hill. You spent time in the administration. You're back in another administration. The message really isn't getting through. How much of this, you know, A, what's it going to take to finally get that message through? Or is this really the new normal? I mean, however much we decry it. And what are some things and mechanisms the department can actually use at this point to actually garner at least some more degree of flexibility, some more degree of planning? I mean, what needs to change? Because basically we're doing the same thing over and over again. And now we're paying the ultimate price by not even being able to rearm as quickly as circumstances demand that we rearm.
Yeah, I think I would just start by saying that, you know, we're in a competition right now in terms of the development of military capabilities with the PRC, with China. We are obviously witnessing the effects of Russian aggression in Europe and the consequences that it has, not only for Ukraine, but really for the security of the entire continent. So it's a very dangerous world we're living in. You know, the national security environment is one in which, you know, the Army and certainly the Department of Defense can't afford to, you know, be hamstrung by the limitations in our ability to receive a regular appropriation, predictable levels of funding, and investments that are needed at the right time in order to be able to develop the capabilities that we know that our warfighters need to have. I think what I would say in answer to your question is we've got to continue to try to reconstitute and reemphasize the bipartisan nature of support for our national security and for the needs and investments that the Department of Defense requires.
How much of this, before I go to some more strategic questions, I mean, how much of this is a flow of money issue in terms of rearming? I know Doug Bush, the Army Acquisition Executive, has been doing a terrific job to build up artillery shell production. And there are really almost quantum increases in capability that we've seen as we look forward to hitting some of our very ambitious targets next year. But from your perspective, how much of this is a supply chain issue? How much of this is a flow of money issue? How much of this is a slow process? Because there are a lot of people who are a little frustrated, I think, to put it mildly, that 2 years ago, we were saying it'll take about 3 years. And here we are 2 years later, and now we're saying it's another 3 years, right? People are getting the sense that there might not be the alacrity needed to rearm, given that World War II was 3 years, 9 months in its total span. What are the elements of this that are making the whole thing move slowly, aside from, obviously, the congressional part of it?
It really is a lack of steady funding that's causing a challenge. But I will say that I am very grateful to the urgency that has been displayed by our industrial base. I think they have leaned very far forward and, you know, invested, you know, not only in terms of their own R&D, but their own capital investment to be able to provide the capability and the production capacity that the United States needs. I do think that it is a whole of government approach. And certainly the investments that we've been able to make in terms of the last year supplementals, for example, with Congress's bipartisan support, have provided a lot of resources to be able to expand a lot of our facilities to match greater levels of production. And we're seeing the effects of that today, and I think we're going to continue to see that. What we just need now is continued support in the last supplemental that we've got in FY24. The current supplemental that's currently pending in Congress, you know, we need that support. And I'll give you an example. So on 155 artillery, you know, we have set a goal for ourselves to get to 100,000 rounds per month by the end of calendar year 25. In order to get there, we need the production that is paid for in the 24 appropriation, and we also need the capital investments that are made available in the final supplemental that is currently pending in Congress. If we do not get both pieces of legislation it will be very difficult for us to meet that target. And so what does that mean? Is it will challenge our ability to replenish our stocks and to provide additional capability to our allies and partners.
Early on in this, you and I had a conversation in which you were sort of talking about the magnitude of the task. This was some 2 years ago, soon after the invasion, where, look, we don't want yesterday's thingers tomorrow, right? I mean, there are supply chain issues, and it requires redesign, certification. And it you know, there are many who say that actually the process is moving much more quickly. And even if it seems like there isn't a lot of activity, there's going to be actually more output more quickly. What can you tell us about that sort of the pipeline and the process, as you'd said at that point, if we get the process right on this, we're going to be able to move much, much faster no matter what we do going forward. Where are you on that entire process that you, Doug Bush, the secretary, the chief, I mean, the whole team have been working to try to accelerate on the requirements side, the certification side, the design? Right, you're working also, as you said, with your industry partners. Where are you on that process, and how are you moving everything faster?
It's going very well. Staying in the zone or in the portfolio of critical munitions, you know, we started out when the invasion of Ukraine started in 2022 with limited stocks, as you know, of our Stingers, and of course, many of the components that go to our Stingers were not in current production. There were parts obsolescence concerns. We were gearing up for a redesign and an improved capability, a new version of Stinger, if you will. And you know, since then, what we've been able to do is greatly accelerate the R&D effort to you know, move forward and lean forward on a next generation Stinger design that industry will be able to provide for the Army and to our allies and partners, as well as some very creative efforts to you know, even reverse engineer in some cases some of the you know, critical components that were no longer in production to enable us to provide, you know, more capability in a near term. We had Stingers, for example, that needed to be recertified using components from you know, different quantities to be able to generate more capability that we've been able to either use ourselves for training or to provide to Ukraine in the past. So I think that you know, it's a good example of putting a lot of ingenuity and organizational emphasis on getting the most capability we possibly can in a short amount of time.
You're right. And you guys are replicating that, by the way, right? I mean, Stinger, I think, is an example. You guys are trying to do this across multiple weapons platforms as well.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I mean, I think the broader question here that you're getting to is how quickly we need to iterate and adapt. Particularly as the threat continues to evolve, as technology continues to you know, kind of evolve in a very iterative fashion. The best example is what I mentioned earlier on counter UAS. We know that the threat UAS systems that you know, we see around the world are low cost. They're upgraded, you know, vary on a regular cycle. Some of the new improvements that are made to enemy UAS systems are more resistant to, for example, non-kinetic, you know, defensive efforts that we have. So it is a cat and mouse game to try to continuously stay ahead of the threat. And so, you know, the challenge we face is how do we make sure that we set up our investments and the development of our counter UAS capabilities to be able to match that?
We've had a couple of opportunities to talk since Russia's latest invasion of Ukraine, and the Army always likes to be deliberate about lessons learned. Now, some of those lessons are beginning to shape weapons decisions. We had the recent cancellation of the Future Armed Reconnaissance Aircraft that was driven by those battlefield lessons. What are the top lessons the Army has learned, both from the Ukraine campaign and even more recently from Gaza, that shapes the kind of capabilities you need for the future, whether you're in Europe or in the Indo-Pacific?
Absolutely. You know, we continue to learn lessons from Ukraine. And I would just say that it's hard to draw some final conclusions when the conflict is ongoing. But I will say that there are a couple of areas that are definitely informing our thinking. First, I've emphasized the UAS threat, which is very much real. It is something that the Ukrainian forces are contending with on an ongoing basis, and how that continues to be a threat that evolves very, very rapidly and quickly is one that I think, you know, any major force in conflict is going to have to contend with moving forward. The second is, you know, obviously the need to be very mobile and very hidden within the electromagnetic spectrum. I think that the way General George, our chief of staff, explains it well is there's really nowhere to hide on today's battlefield. And he expects that that will continue to be the case moving forward. So what it means for not just for the United States Army, but for any land force is the ability to do command and control in a very concise way on the move with a very limited footprint across the electromagnetic signature. And so I think as we think about our capabilities, we have to be mindful of that. And then third is, you know, very early in the conflict, I think we learned a lot from watching the Russian forces' performance on the value of, you know, logistics, particularly in a very contested environment. And so as we have responded, we set up a cross-functional team in Army Futures Command to look at contested logistics, particularly with an eye not just on the European continent, but also in the Indo-Pacific region on how the Army will provide a capability as part of the joint force. And in that area, you know, we are looking at, you know, even sustainment of our platforms and areas where we've learned from Ukraine about things like telemaintenance and additive manufacturing, all the way to the C2 of command and control of logistics in areas like predictive logistics and the ability to provide protected supply lines and to do intra-theater movement of capabilities. I think we're learning a lot from what we're observing in Europe and also from our exercises that we continue to do in the Pacific.
And a quick word from our sponsors, the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, and American Rheinmetall. Let me ask one quick follow-up to that, because I'd want to get to broader strategy and budget questions in a moment. But one of the things that's most impressive is how the Ukrainians are doing rapid adaptation cycles, right? I mean, historically, the Army and the U.S. military has a tendency of looking at systems over decades, not electromagnetic systems that will have to be replaced in weeks, right? The nature of advantage is very different. How is that shaping, that agility lesson, shaping how you regard the future, how you regard future systems and their utility, given, you know, the Army has a tendency of buying something and using it literally until the wheels fall off decades later?
Yeah, I would say it's very much changing in one key facet. And it's changed just even in the course of my career serving in the Army in the Pentagon. You know, I think if you look back 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we're very focused on fielding systems and capabilities in a very standardized way across the entire total Army, all three compos, every unit, everywhere we train, everywhere we operate. I think there has been a recognition, which I think has been accelerated by what we've witnessed in Ukraine, on the need to iterate on capability, even in smaller batches, much, much, much more quickly. And it's okay for certain units that are deploying to both deploy with, experiment with, and operate different types of non-standard equipment and to learn how to use them effectively on the battlefield. That's what the Ukrainians are doing very, very well. And I would also add, unleashing some innovation from soldiers on the front lines of how to use existing capabilities maybe in different ways. I would note that we were very impressed in just watching, for example, the creative ways in which the Ukrainian forces would use spare parts or even, materials from other platforms that they had, and they would rapidly configure and shape them and integrate them to provide different kinds of capabilities on the battlefield. That kind of ingenuity, the ability to kind of think on your feet, if you will, is exactly what the Army would need to do moving forward. And we're doing a lot in this space and trying to inculcate that thinking into our units.
And I would point out, right, Army Futures Command and General Rainey and the team there have been paying particular attention to what all this looks like. One of the things that the Army has been working toward, and I know you've been working hard on this, is drawing on all of these lessons, as well as what the demands of the Indo-Pacific are going to mean for what the future or the Army's future organization and structure are going to look like. You're in the midst of a budget planning exercise, or actually it's almost all done. The fighting with OMB is pretty much over, and hopefully the outcome is to your liking, sir. There are already news reports on what that transformation means for the Army. We've seen what the Air Force has done, and we had an expectation each of the services were going to trim their sales as well. News reports that the Army would shrink by about 24,000, that thousands of smaller installations would be consolidated, as well as some other deep muscle movements to reshape the force and better optimize it for great power competition. From your standpoint, I know you don't want to get ahead of the budget, but what are some muscle movements, major muscle movements, you know, aside from getting rid of FARA and saving $4 billion that can be used elsewhere? What are some of the other big muscle movements we're going to be seeing out of the Army in this coming budget?
Well, I think we've talked a lot about our force structure changes, which is what drives a lot of what you'll see in the 25 budget. So the story there is obviously the Army has been in the midst of a transformation from one aligned to counterterrorism operations during Iraq and Afghanistan, to one that's optimized for great power competition and the threats that we would face in the future. And what that really focused in on is, you know, shifting, for example, some of the aspects of our BCTs, you know, realigning some of the capabilities within our brigades, shedding some capabilities and adding capabilities that are aligned to kind of where we need to go. I'll just give you, you know, really a couple of examples. We know that in the future, the role that the Army plays, for example, in the Indo-Pacific, is in the area of air and missile defense and long-range fires. So a lot of our emphasis for the last couple of years has been, how do we grow the structure, the manning, the people, as well as the equipment to be able to provide, for example, long-range fires battalions, you know, for commanders in the Pacific theater to be able to utilize in the event of a conflict, and certainly provide a deterrent capability. All of the air and missile defense capabilities that we've been growing, whether it's obviously our Patriot battalions, but our new IFPC capability and all of the associated range of air missile defense systems that the Army fields, can we grow the structure to provide that in an area that could be very much contested, like the Indo-Pacific, and supporting the joint force? Well, in order to grow the structure to do that, it's very hard to do when you have manning challenges like the Army has had, given our recruiting challenges. So in order to, you know, kind of almost pay for that growth of what we needed to find some other areas of structure that we could bring down. Otherwise, we would carry way too many billets or positions and authorizations, if you will, that would not be able to be filled. And we certainly did not want to have a hollow army. So we took a very long time to do some analysis, and we found areas that we could come down and reduce structure. And it boiled down to areas, first and foremost, where, you know, it was aligned to different, you know, military occupational specialties, different, you know, branches of the Army, where we felt that there was growth that we could bring down. You know, we also looked at, for example, the structure that, you know, we were utilizing pretty frequently and what we were not utilizing very frequently. And that gave us an indication of where we might be able to bring some structure down. And then finally, on our close combat forces, I mentioned earlier, the BCT changes, they were all about necking down to the capabilities that are optimized for a large scale combat operation environment. Some of the things like our weapons companies and our cavalry squadrons that had grown during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we were able to divest those in order to make room to grow the new capabilities that we know that we needed moving forward. You know, we are growing our multi-domain task forces over the next several years. You know, they are going to be a capability that includes long-range fires, to include long-range hypersonic weapon, mid-range capability, as well as air and missile defense capabilities, and what we call our multi-domain effects battalions, which have EW, cyber, and other critical capabilities that they can bring to the fight. All of these are in the process of growing, and so that is what we prioritize as we're looking at our force structure moving forward.
How do you respond to those, right? I mean, I was speaking to friends of mine, some friends before this conversation, and they were still not convinced that the Army really has as good of a strategy, particularly for the Indo-Pacific. I mean, how do you respond to those who say that despite the years, the Army has not fully wrapped its arms around what its Indo-Pacific role is, right? I mean, even though it, as you said, it's logistics, it's special operations, it's air and missile defenses, you know, because the criticism is, well, the service really is underinvested in some of these places anyway. How do you respond to those who still question whether there's clarity in the Army's strategy and what its role is on a modern contested battlefield, whether it's in Europe or frankly, and particularly in the Indo-Pacific?
Well, I would really challenge kind of some of that perception, and I would just point to the facts. So if you look at it over a time horizon, you know, right now, what we are working to do is to deter China from taking action against Taiwan in that region. And, you know, the best deterrent capability is what the United States is focused on in this administration, which is to build partnerships, build, you know, strong links to our allies in the region, and to foster that multinational kind of cooperation and effort. The best way to do that is to build connections between the militaries that exist in the region and that of the United States. Almost every nation has an army, and the army has invested significantly over the last several years into those multinational exercises like Balikatan and other major exercises as part of Pacific Pathways. The goal there is to not only to build capacity in our partners and allies, but to also to signal that very strong deterrent that the United States, if asked to take action, has allies and partners in the region. The Army has been at the forefront of many of those exercises, again, because we are the common link with those nations. So I think if you look at where we are in the time horizon we exist in today, the Army has had a very, very valuable and very important and visible role. I think down the road, in the event of a potential conflict, the Army has defined and very clearly expressed what its role is going to be. It's going to be first to provide that critical logistics function, and we have invested very significantly, whether it's in Army watercraft that you have seen us develop over the last couple of years, investments in autonomous resupply, fuel and power and water distribution and storage, all the things that maybe might not make the same headlines as a large platform, but they are absolutely critical to the joint force, and those have been emphasized in our budget. And then third, I would also say that, you know, the air and missile defense and long-range fires capabilities reflect a multi-year investment by the Army to prioritize that. You know, we are continuing to lead the charge if you look at air and missile defense, not just with our Patriots, but our IFPC, MSHORAD formations. There are a lot of capabilities the Army's invested in. And if you just look at the overall investment in weapon systems in the Army, air and missile defense has gone from one of the most underinvested portfolios, you know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, to one of the most, if not the most, across the Army, recognizing that that is something that the joint force needs from us. And our investment has recognized that and reflects it. So I think you have to take a larger look at what's going on in the region, you know, where we are at different time horizons, how the Army contributes to deterrence. And I think for those who are there, you will say that we have a very, very significant role to play.
Let me ask you a question about FARA and the aftermath of that decision. Sure. The concern always with the Army is that some of its highest priorities are very dependent on whoever the senior leader is. The last chief of staff was a master aviator, and this was the notion of a better armed reconnaissance aircraft was a priority, and it was a very fundamental pillar of the future vertical lift effort, one of which was executed the future long range assault aircraft. And Army leaders at the time of FARA's cancellation said, hey, more resources would be going into FLRAA, for example, as well as Army aviation, that money would not go to waste. But the question that many people in industry are asking, whether they're in the armored vehicle side of things, in the aviation side of it, or elsewhere in the wake of the decision is, a week before FARA was canceled, Army leaders were telling industry that FARA remained a top priority. And then a week later, it ended up not being as top of a priority. And so there's a little bit of concern about the Army's acquisition efforts that span back to Comanche, Crusader, and of course, Future Combat Systems. From your standpoint, what's the message to industry? Because there are some who are concerned about whatever the Army's stated acquisition priorities are and whether they're sort of temporal as opposed to actual lasting priorities. I mean, it was an Army friend that pointed out that, well, the Air Force doesn't really do this. Like, the Air Force just says, this is my priority, and they execute to that. How do you respond to people in industry who are a little bit concerned in the wake of this decision? Yeah, and folks who are looking at this and saying, look, this was billions in resources that were consumed. And actually, the other arm of a future vertical lift could be as vulnerable, ultimately.
Well, I would first of all challenge kind of that characterization. First of all, we don't make decisions based on personalities. We're guided by analysis. We're guided by realities in terms of where the requirement and the threat is shifting, and more importantly, what we are able to resource given our budget constraints. So I think that all comes together to explain the decision to no longer continue the FARA program. I would also say that if you look at our track record on all of the modernization priorities that were kind of laid out back in 2018 along the six main areas and the multitude of programs that kind of went along with that, our track record has been very good over the last several years. The number of programs that continue to work their way through the process and actually deliver operational capability to soldiers, it's really high. I mean, we have fielded the Next Generation Squad Weapon. We have begun to get ready to field the mid-range capability, and units are training with the long-range hypersonic weapon. We are in the latter stages of continuing to develop a Bradley replacement after many years of effort. We have awarded the contract to develop the FLRAA, which is the kind of obviously a different platform than the FARA, right, in terms of of aerial reconnaissance. So our track record the last couple of years has been showing that we are getting a lot of momentum across the portfolio. FARA is a unique case. If you look at the aviation portfolio, the concern that we expressed was that we had two competing pressures that drove the decision. On the one hand, you had a change in kind of where the requirement and the threat was heading. We right. recognized, as we observed in Ukraine, that the proliferation of low cost, readily available sources for reconnaissance meant that we needed to relook how we were going to meet all of our aerial reconnaissance requirements. And I'll start with this key observation that maybe doesn't get reported on a lot. We have a requirement for sensing, and that includes aerial reconnaissance, but it's always a blend of capabilities that we use depending on the mission. It's some of them are joint space-based sensors, for example. Some of them are other aerial sensing platforms that we have, such as long endurance, long range sensing platforms. Some of them involve armed reconnaissance, manned helicopters. And we've been doing that mission since we retired the Kiowas with Apaches. And then some of it also includes launched effects, which is, kind of the proliferation of either sensing capabilities launched from aviation platforms, both manned and unmanned, as well as ground-based. So it's always a blend of all of those sources of reconnaissance. So as we looked ahead, what is the best way to use our investment? Is it to kind of invest across this portfolio and ensure that we have multiple options given the missions and the potential conflicts we face tomorrow? Or should we overinvest in one aerial reconnaissance platform that is manned? Clearly, we made the decision that based on where the threat was going and the available technology, it just did not make economic sense for the Army to continue to invest in that particular platform. Plus, we also faced some very significant industrial-based challenges in the aviation portfolio for the Army. Given the fact that we're facing budget caps and other constraints, the idea that we would have challenges with our Chinook and our Black Hawk aviation platforms with no signs of production in the out years was a challenge, an industrial-based risk that we did not want to face. We learned a lot over the last couple of years about the need to maintain a healthy industrial base and to keep up production levels. That is what enables us to have that industrial base resilience. And so we made the very difficult choice that we wanted to invest in a CH-47 Block 2 program, in another multi-year of the UH-60 Mike model Blackhawks, as well as continuing to invest in the development of FLRAA, an acceleration of our unmanned aerial program, which is FTUAS. All of this combined was to give the Army better and more options over the long run And we had to make the very challenging decision not to overinvest in one single armed reconnaissance platform that was manned.
And sir, you've been very generous with your time. Let me ask you about the supplemental and its importance. I mean, we're now looking at this, you know, maybe coming through in a month, maybe coming through, as we heard on the Friday roundtable in August, which, you know, some people say is a little bit too late to help our Ukrainian allies. How important is that supplemental to the United States Army and your ability to generate American combat power, whether it's for an ally or whether it's for ourselves?
I would just say that, you know, we cannot lose sight of the fact that the supplemental is absolutely vital to the Army's well-being immediately. And I'll give you a couple of examples why. So the supplemental contains funding to reimburse the Army for ongoing operations costs for our forces that are deployed to Europe to provide reassurance to NATO members. It is also reimbursing us for our ongoing operations this year in the CENTCOM region. And in addition to that, it provides a lot of support on the replenishment of capabilities that we have provided to Ukraine through the presidential drawdown process. If we do not get that supplemental, the United States Army will continue to cash flow those operations to the tune of over $1 billion so far this year out of our existing accounts that we did not plan for. So what does that mean? It will continue to constrain the resources that we can apply to other valuable and important areas of Army modernization. And I would just also note that, you know, without the replenishment funds that are in the supplemental, the Army will not be able to continue to buy back new capabilities to replace what we have drawn down and provided to Ukraine. And it gives the Army an important and valuable opportunity to modernize. Every time I can replace an M113 with an AMPV, it is good for the United States Army. It gives our soldiers a better capability. And I would just lastly point out that, you know, almost all of the funding that is in the supplemental will either come directly to the Army or it will go to our industrial-based partners here in the continental United States. So it's good for industry.
Sir, honor and pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so much for being so generous with your time. We really, really appreciate it. All the best.
Thanks so much, Vago. Appreciate it.